Welcome to this week's podcast of Kicking It with Kidneys with your host, Cindy Barclay. Hey, Cindy, take it away.
Welcome to Kicking It with Kidneys, a forum to discuss topics important to the dialysis community and provide a legitimate platform for those whose voices have historically been suppressed. During our previous episode, we discussed the primary causes of chronic kidney disease, the symptoms, and the five stages of progression. We also identified the population of people, namely African Americans, Native Americans, and Hispanics, most affected, and the educational deficits that exist within these communities of color. Now, in this episode, we will talk about the final four. There are four treatment options resulting from stage five kidney failure, which is commonly referred to as end-stage renal disease. Our panelists will explore these treatment options, the risk, and the cost associated. Now, our panelist is back to look at these treatment options, and today we have Maria Jimenez, RN and Administrator of Quality Dialysis. We have Rita Williams, a licensed renal social worker. Sarita Scarborough, Master's in Business Administration and Entrepreneur. And BJ Simone, Master's in Sociology, Health Services Researcher and Trainer. All right, BJ, what is the word on the street?
Okay, Cindy. Well, we were very interested in how much the average dialysis patient knows about their condition, and even more importantly, how much do they know about their treatment options? So let's listen to what our people on the street have to say.
All right.
Word on the street with Simone.
Hey, Simone. We are today talking to dialysis patients, and we asked them, do you know why your kidneys failed? And what did your doctor tell you about your treatment options before you started dialysis? Here's what they had to say.
My kidneys failed from diabetes. My doctor did not give me an option, but once I started going for treatment, they told me that I could be a good candidate for a transplant if I follow the diet and adhere to the instructions. I am now waiting on a kidney.
My kidney failed because I have high blood pressure options. I'm not sure what you mean by that. I go to treatment three times a week on Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday. I do the best that I can. I'm trying to stay alive as long as I can.
Well, I was told it was my high blood pressure and my the kidney stones that I had. And I didn't want to, go through with the way that they were going to do it. And I was just, I'm not understanding how. All I know is I was told that they failed. What options? I wasn't told that I had any options. He just told me to go to the clinic and start my treatment. And that, I'm following his instructions, and that's what I do. Then if there are any other options, I would love to know that I have other options. But I wasn't given any options. I'm just following his instructions. I just want to live, But if there are any options, I'd like to know. I mean, this is okay, but I'm not thrilled about, doing this here every other day. If there's some new treatment or something, I'd love to know about it.
We thank our respondents. Listen, it seems from our respondents that there's still work to be done in getting more information to people.
Most definitely.
Particularly regarding what's going on in their bodies and what are viable treatment options.
All right. Well, to help us with that, we have Maria. Maria will give us a little recap on the five stages of end-stage renal disease, and she's also going to explain the four treatments option for us. Maria?
All right. Hi. Just recapping from last week, we did discuss the GFR, identifying the five stages of CKD, chronic kidney disease. Stage one, GFR, glomerular filtration rate, is at 90 above. Stage two is mild, between 60 and 89 GFR. Stage three is broken down into two, stage 3A, stage 3B, which includes your GFR between 30 and 59. Stage four is considered severe. That's where your GFR is between 15 and 29, and end stage, time for dialysis, less than 15. Your four treatment options, number one would be home hemodialysis. Mm-hmm. Number two would be in-center hemodialysis. Mm-hmm. Number three is peritoneal dialysis. And number four, we have transplantation.
Okay, so there must be a five then. I thought there were four, but it must be a five. What about some patients choose not to
have the option dialysis of no treatment.
Okay. And that would mean that
the inevitable. I mean, if your kidneys aren't working and you're not doing one of the four main options, you're considering comfort measures at that point, and just trying to maybe follow diet and do the best that you can until transition. It's inevitable, unfortunately.
Like what you would call palliative care, or hospice care.
Yeah. So who's responsible for informing the patient about those four treatment options?
Well, your nephrologist, the kidney doctor, the doctor that's saying, hey, your kidneys are failing. So that at that point, the doctor, the team, his education team, should be giving patients those options for dialysis.
Okay. So are there risk factors associated with those treatment options? Can we go in that today or?
There are. So there's advantages and disadvantages with all of these treatment options.
Okay.
First, starting with home hemodialysis, you can basically control your schedule. You have flexibility over when you're dialyzing because you're doing it home yourself.
Okay.
You don't have to travel to the clinic. You're involved in your own care. You have a less restricted diet because you're dialyzing between 5 and 6 times per week on this modality, and your medications may be fewer. Your disadvantages are, you know, you have to have a partner to help you. Training can, you know, take some time out of a busy work schedule. You need to have space for supplies and equipment in the home, and you need to fit dialysis into a daily routine of your life.
So do you need to have like this sterile environment when you're dialyzing at home, or can you be poor and clean?
You need to be clean.
Okay. So you can be clean
poor and clean. You can be poor and clean.
Poor and clean. Yeah. Okay. All right. Okay.
The next one would be in-center hemodialysis. The advantages of this is that you have technicians and nurses that are actually doing the treatments for you. You have regular contact with other dialysis patients and staff. Mm-hmm. It's 3 days a week. So you're on 3 days and then you have 4 days that is off. You have no equipment in the home. And you have medical help readily available in those centers for emergencies. Disadvantages of going in center would be that you would have to travel from your home on a fixed schedule to a clinic 3 times a week based off of what their availability would be. Mm-hmm. You may feel tired or worn down because it's a lot more hard on the body. They're trying to do the same job in 3 to 4 hours.
Yeah, I heard it was like you're running track. Right. That you're so exhausted afterwards.
It's possible. Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You have a more restricted diet. You could have more problems with cramping, muscle aches, tiredness, as we just discussed. Peritoneal dialysis. You control your dialysis schedule. This is also a different type of home modality. You don't have to travel to a center for treatment again. Again, you're involved in your care. There's no needles at all involved with this, no blood involved with this type of modality. You may have more flexibility with your diet and fluid restrictions as you're dialyzing more often. Travel, easier to travel. And you don't have to have a partner to form, you know, to perform this type of treatment.
Now, can you get your training? Is your training in center or can you get your training at home?
Well, I think that depends on the money.
Okay.
Again.
All right. We'll get to that in a minute.
Okay. But disadvantages of peritoneal dialysis, you may have a greater waistline gain. You have fluid that's, you know, instilled into the peritoneal, your abdominal cavity area that can give you a little larger girth or waistline for the women. You have to be able to have space for your supplies, and you have to be really, really committed to self-care with peritoneal dialysis.
Okay.
Maria.
Yes.
What is peritoneal dialysis? I mean, for someone who doesn't know anything.
So the difference between peritoneal and hemo, HD and PD. The word heme in hemodialysis means blood. So that's where you're seeing the cleaning of the blood. That's where the ultrafiltration is happening. That's where the cleaning is happening, is through the blood. Peritoneal has nothing to do with blood. Basically, you'll have a peritoneal dialysis catheter placed in the abdominal cavity. And you'll just basically do cleaning of the blood, basically, and ultrafiltration without blood. You indwell fluid and then you release the fluid. And then there are exchanges that happen overnight while you sleep.
Right.
So that's
right,
another
right.
Oh, yeah.
Right. So one is with blood. Okay. The hemo is with a shunt or some type of catheter.
Right.
And with the peritoneal, it's just the peritoneal membrane that basically serves as a filter is what you're saying.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
So like a coffee filter, you know, it would just filtering out, there you know. Go. And we'll get into more about that mm-hmm. later. Okay. Sarita?
Ms. Barclay? I looked for
you. I'm Ms. Barclay now. So what happened? What's
I looked up? For you because you were coming around to see where the pharmacies were.
Uh-huh.
Sat on my porch with my lemonade, never saw you. But my people did have a question.
Okay, okay.
For Nurse Maria.
Okay. Oh, not for me.
No.
Okay,
for Nurse Maria. I just want to let you know you never rode by my house and
okay,
waved at me.
In the hood. Okay, all right.
But, Nurse Maria.
Accountability.
That's right.
Yes,
accountability.
Ma'am.
The people asked me, where exactly are your kidneys? Where are they located in your body?
They're located in the lower portion of the... I guess the posterior side of your body. In the back.
So go down
you have
to
two
your,
of them.
Can I help with that? Go down by your butt.
Uh-huh.
Take both of your on both sides.
Hands on the hips, basically.
Hands on the hips, and follow that all the way up by your spinal cord.
Uh-huh.
And right below that, that's where the kidneys are located on each side.
Okay, because the only thing we could do last week was press on the ankle and the toe because we weren't quite sure where those kidneys were located.
Okay, Maria, can you continue? That's Sarita. Okay, go ahead.
Lastly, on transplantation, the pros and cons of transplant. Pros are it's the closest to having your own kidneys.
Right.
Mm-hmm. No dialysis is required. Once the kidney starts working, you actually have a longer life with a transplant than being on dialysis. Less fluid restrictions and diet restrictions. You may have more energy and you can work a full schedule without worrying about a dialysis schedule. The cons would be the stress of waiting for that mm-hmm. transplant mm-hmm. or waiting for the match.
Mm-hmm.
That can be very stressful, a long time period of time.
I think like 3 to 5 years it can be.
If you do not have your own donor.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I have one question before I go to Rita Maria. Tell me something. Can you get a transplant if you have been following a doctor and you have a donor? Can you get a transplant before you go on dialysis?
Absolutely. It is definitely an option.
Okay, so I don't hear a lot of talk about that. Rita, can you help me out
sure,
here?
Sure, definitely. And like you said, you can't get a transplant before that because you've been working with your nephrologist, you've been working with your nutritionist
who's
and
the,
all that.
Who's the nephrologist? You're talking about the kidney doctor?
The kidney doctor, the kidney doctor.
We've Sarita been working, needs to understand
yes,
that.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
We've been working with the kidney doctor and say that you do have a living donor, uh-huh. which is the easiest and the fastest way to get a kidney transplant
right.
to have maybe a living donor. It could be a family member. It could be a friend. It could be a stranger. They just have to match up to you.
Okay. Okay.
So, yeah, you can do it before you even step a foot inside a dialysis unit.
So what are the social... As a social worker, what is your role in preparing and supporting these treatment option initiatives? And what is the interest in plantation based on racial ethnicities?
Okay.
Primarily Latinos and African Americans.
Okay. And what we do with that is we will sit down, like Maria said, it is part of the education. By the time they get to the center, mm-hmm. a lot of them have made their decision either to do hemo or to do PD or to do home dialysis or do nothing. We already know that.
Uh-huh.
So
uh-huh.
with that, we just need to continue to educate our patients because life is flowy. It flows. You know, at one point, hemo may have been the best option for me,
mm-hmm.
but I can switch over to PD.
Oh, you can vice versa?
Yeah.
You can
we have to switch out the catheter and the peritoneal
mm-hmm.
catheter as
well.
Yeah.
Take out one, put in another one.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
After you speak with your physician.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
definitely.
Mm-hmm.
You can do that. Or if you are on PD, don't want to do hemo, don't want to do transplant, you can do the nothing. And we talk about that as well. What is that going to look like for you? So let me talk a little bit about how do we get started on a transplant.
Okay.
So the
okay.
first thing is you'll talk it over with your doctor. If you are in stage 5, right, that's when we start dialysis.
We start dialysis at stage 5.
Yeah. Yeah. So we're there. And we talk to our doctor and we say, you know what? We do want to do transplant.
Mm-hmm.
The doctor will write out what's called a referral. And it'll go to a transplant center in our transplant hospital here in the metro area. We have three of those, which is St. Luke's, Herman Memorial, and somebody help me.
Methodist.
Methodist. Mm-hmm. I always forget.
You're talking about in Houston, Texas. We're talking to people all over the world. So
in Houston or in Houston, Texas metro area, that's what we're doing.
Okay.
And we also have the Galveston Hospital.
Okay.
So we can sign up. In Texas, there's actually 22 units around.
Okay.
So there's a bunch. There's some in Fort Worth. There's some down in San Antonio. There's some in the Rio Grande Valley area. So there is a lot of options. Now, can you list at several of those? It depends on you. I have patients that are listed in San Antonio as well.
Okay.
It depends on you, how far you want to travel.
Okay. And how bad you want that kidney.
And how bad you want that kidney. Because, you know, once you get that referral, they do an evaluation on you. And it's a lot of testing. They do blood and tissue. They test for HIV and hepatitis. They do prostate exams for men, mammograms and pap smears for women. They do tests on your lungs and your heart, your kidneys, your liver test, colon exam. You need to
great
be in
screening.
Great screening. Great, complete screening. Because they want you to be in the best health you can be.
Right. They don't want to waste that kidney.
That's right.
Okay. But in our communities, and I want to talk to BJ about this, you know, Black folks, we ain't trying to give you our kidney. There's this, I don't know about the Latino population.
The Latinos, I think we're kind of the same. Tell me what y'all think.
But you know, if God, the same way God brought me here,
right,
is how I'm leaving.
Right.
And he didn't intend for me to give you no kidney, Rita.
Oh.
Okay. So that's what we think. It's a religious thing, or it could just be selfish. But I think sometimes I think people think that if you're on that donor list with UNOS, okay, that they think that, oh,
the doctor's going to let you go if you get sick.
Yeah.
If you get sick,
go to the hospital, going to kill you.
That's one of the myths.
That's one of the myths.
And one of the other things I want, when talking about religion, every major religion in the United States supports organ, eye, and tissue donation as one of the highest expressions of compassion and generosity.
So you're saying that if I die, God will find me wherever I am,
whether I'm
cremated or whatever.
Yes, he will.
So BJ, what is the problem? What are some of the social barriers that contribute to the underrepresentation of minorities as it relates to transplantation, whether it be a heart, a lung, a kidney, a liver, whatever, you know, what are the socioeconomic kind of roadblocks for people of color?
Okay, Cindy. Well, there are many, but I would like to highlight at least four primary ones. The first one we've already heard when we listen to our people on the street, and that is a lack of awareness and understanding about the treatment options. I think they clearly stated it, especially our last respondent. So helping minority patients understand the full range of treatments, options, that's just one area that is represented by our nationwide disparity in healthcare. The second one is medical bias.
Okay.
As Rita brought out, assessments are made regarding the viability of a patient's candidacy for being a transplant recipient. And I think it's fair to say that there's potential for unconscious bias to exist where minority patients particularly are concerned.
Right.
There's an underlying ideology that clinicians subscribe to when they're assessing a transplant patient, and it's this view that they are deciding what is in the greater good for the society as a whole. And part of that is determining how they can maximize the use of medical technology while they're minimizing the overall cost. And that is where the bias occurs. When they're exercising this duty. I'm going to give you an example.
Okay.
In one study, it was determined that there was a higher rate of noncompliance with post-transplant immunosuppressant medication by African-American patients.
Well, if they don't have a job.
But that was one study. And they were saying, you know, the conclusion of that study was that African-Americans, there's a higher rate for them not being compliant. But later, there was another study that discovered that the racial differences that had been presumed to be the result of poor compliance was actually caused by racial differences in drug absorption and metabolism. Get that word out. You know, this is one example where, you know, oftentimes in the healthcare profession, you have these theories and these assumptions without looking at other underlying causes. And then there's the other assumptions based on minority status, such as age and income. And I think it's fair to assume that for minority patients, they may be older at the point of diagnosis, simply because if we assume that they're not getting the preventative care, they're not going to know until they're older that that they have it. And of course, the income, you know, more. So the problem here is that all of this is factored into decisions about the contributions that they're going to make to society if society puts a significant investment in their health care and their longevity. Very quickly, I'm not going to go into detail on the others because we have limited time, but one is the increase in comorbidities that minority patients have. And from our last program, we heard one of our respondents list a number of health crises that they have that prevented him from moving forward with the transplant process. So I think, again, we can see that across the board, minority patients rate higher on every index of health
disparity
comorbidities. And if you guys remember, that was one of the primary reasons that minority groups were hit so hard during the pandemic.
That is correct.
And then just very quickly, the resources. One of the things that Serena was talking about and Maria was talking about is the resources minority patients have just in their family support, their the social support. And then one of the things that wasn't brought up when we were saying that transplant patients oftentimes are given this battery of tests, we don't think about the emotional and mental health component of that.
They're also
screened for that. And then the final thing is something you mentioned, Cindy, early on, is what is considered misguided beliefs. There's this assumption or that associated with previously mentioned barriers where we can't ignore the belief systems that people have, and particularly minority communities, in terms of their mistrust of medical profession and procedures, particularly things that are complex, like the transplant operations. Something that I think is equally important is this intertwining of a sense of fatalism and spiritual deliverance. We touched on this in the previous show, where dialysis is the predominant treatment option that many minority families and patients are familiar with, especially if that's the treatment that they're guided to. So that's what they're comfortable with. And the other thing is this belief that healthcare professionals are God sent, and therefore you shouldn't question anything that they provide for you. So this also works against minority patients. Yeah, they're all knowing. We don't question them. And if
that's got to change. That's really,
if they believe in this, if they believe in it, it's actually going to work against them because it prevents them from really seeking the best care available. And it also works against them if the healthcare providers use it as a justification for not helping patients make informed decisions.
Correct. What were you going to say, Maria?
I mean, as the healthcare professional, I hear what you're saying and I understand why you're saying that, BJ, but that's an unfortunate statement. People should be able to look at their doctors and their nurses as, I hate to use the word godsend, but, you know, we are the ones that, you know, have the knowledge base, and we should be able to project that, you know, with patients. So unfortunately, it always comes back to the dollar. We should be able to provide those patients with the, you know, modalities or the information they need to make good decisions for their for themselves. So it's a true statement that you made, but it's very unfortunate.
Yes, right. Yes, it is.
Rita, you were going to say, yeah. You know, Maria, one of the things that is, I had spoken to Cindy once, and I shared this, and I would like to share it with the group. My experience with this kind of assumption that many providers feel that you shouldn't ask them, and they get offended if you right. are inquiring too much. Mm-hmm. This was my personal experience. My husband needed to go to the hospital, and he checked himself and went to emergency. The long and short of it is, I have always said I try to be an advocate. So when anybody's in the hospital, if I have to leave and somebody has a family member, I say, here's a notebook. Just jot down who came in, what they did, ask the question.
That's right. That's right.
Well, what happened is he was admitted to the hospital, and we were doing the right thing, but the first provider came in, and he was not someone we knew. He was just a provider that was on call. The second one came in, and my husband's mother and I were both there. He looked at my husband, who by this time had some stubble. Mm. He's also feverish. Mm-hmm. And he looked at him and very glibly said, well, I'm going to ask you this in front of your mother and your wife. You know, do you drink?
Oh, my. Oh, my.
So, you know, again, by this time, I'm epileptic because I
am. Preconceived ideas. Preconceived.
I left the hospital to go home. And I was fortunate that I had a neighbor who was in the healthcare profession. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I was telling him my situation. He says, well, you know, you can move him. I said, what?
I remember that.
He mm-hmm. goes, you know, you can move him. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And went back to the hospital and immediately requested that my husband be moved to another facility. At this point, the hospital staff, now I'm important.
Oh.
Now I'm the person that, oh, we're going to give you every single consideration. I got to speak to the head nurse.
Ooh.
The head nurse on call says, she says, well, ma'am, if you move him, we can't assure his well-being. And I said, if he stays here, you can't assure me his well-being. No, it wasn't. It was free. So
bedside manners out the window.
My experience, unfortunately, like Maria said, it's unfortunate. It's not an isolated experience.
Wow. Wow.
And even I did not know that, oh, well, you know, I can move him. Why can't I move him? He's not held hostage.
Right. Right.
But we don't think in those terms.
But we have got to do better. Minorities have got to do better. You know, we need to ask the hard questions. And Sarita, let me talk to you a minute.
Well, I just had one question for you right quick.
Oh my. Okay, what is that?
How long can a person stay on dialysis? How many years?
Oh, mm-hmm. until they die.
Yeah.
So I know a patient that has been on dialysis for 20 years.
Yeah.
Okay. It's rare now.
Okay.
It's rare now because we find that a lot of noncompliance exists within the African-American communities.
Latinos, we're right behind.
Okay. A lot of noncompliance, which basically kind of speeds up the process. You know, it's not the dialysis.
Dialysis is meant to keep you here. It's a renal replacement therapy. Right. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So that's not why you're going to die. Mm-hmm. That's what's keeping you here.
It's the comorbidities.
It's the comorbid conditions. It's also compliance.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah.
And is there an average?
The average dialysis person, I think, is like 5 to 10 years.
Yeah.
Okay.
Something like that.
Okay. Mm-hmm. That's all. Mm-hmm. Proceed.
Well, no, let's go on back to the money since you opened up a can of worms that you know
can
you always.
Can I say something right quick?
Can you get her off my back?
Yeah. Okay. Just one thing. $400,000 for a transplant. That's what it costs.
Oh.
Kidney transplantation. All right, Sarita, I know you know about money and the cost of business and dialysis and kidney transplantation in the U.S.
Well, I'm listening to her number now. I did my little research.
Okay, hey, what'd
you find?
Well, I got a little problem. According to UNOS, which for those listening who don't know what that is, that's the United Network for Organ Sharing.
Mm-hmm. What do they do, Sarita? I know you're in finance.
They track all the data mm-hmm. related to patients that have been transplanted.
Right.
Okay. A little different from USRDS.
Okay. Right.
But this is heart, this is lung, this is kidney, everything. Pancreas,
mm-hmm. intestines.
Mm-hmm. Any kind of transplant. So kind of had to dig down through it.
Mm-hmm.
But one thing we also have to separate are the individuals who have private insurance
yes.
from the individuals on Medicare.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So a private insured individual is really looking at 10 to 50% of their co-insurance payment.
Mm-hmm.
So we're gonna get to that math, but I want to establish that out at the beginning.
Okay.
A Medicare patient
mm-hmm.
is looking at $262,000 for the first year
okay.
of the transplant.
Mm-hmm.
Now, circle back around to the private insurance patient.
Okay.
That 10 to 50% can mm-hmm. range anywhere from $26,200 all the way up to $131,000 with private health care insurance.
Okay.
Now we've got one other factor going on there.
What year was that data put out?
Now I'll have to go back and tell you
okay,
that.
I think that's 18, but go ahead. And that's pretty because again, you know, they usually come out with this stuff mm-hmm. 2 years after.
Okay.
The occurrence.
Now your say that word for me.
Immunosuppressed. Did I say that right, Maria?
Yeah.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Immunosuppressed.
So for me and the people that you didn't come see last week.
Okay.
Still.
Your anti-rejection drugs.
That's right.
$17,000 per year.
Yeah.
Now here's the catch.
Is that with Medicare or private insurance companies?
That's $17,000 per year.
Uh-huh.
But Medicare will only cover it for up to 36 months.
Yep.
So now after that, you're on your own.
Yeah. Okay, so what if you don't get... That's what BJ was talking about. That's what Maria was talking about. I mean, the bottom line, BJ is giving me these reasons as to why these patients, you know, with transplantation. However, rejection is a major issue with transplantation. And it's my understanding with the patients that I've spoken with, Maria, most of the patients reject their kidneys because they don't have the funds to continue paying for those anti-rejection drugs when organizations like group healthcare plans and Medicare is unable to pay for them?
It's a factor, but I wouldn't say that is all.
Yeah, I'm with
it's
Murray.
It's compliance.
Okay.
I've got a patient right now, very young girl.
Uh-huh.
Oh, yeah.
26, 28 years old. Dad gave her a kidney 2 Christmases ago.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
She's on dialysis because she was not taking her anti-rejection medication regularly.
My goodness. Psychologically, that bothers me because it's like, I gave you a kidney. I gave you a mm-hmm. precious
right?
part of my body, a kidney that I may need later.
Right.
And you are not conscientious enough to take your anti-rejection
But most
drugs.
People start dialysis because of noncompliance.
Okay.
So
okay.
it should be on the it's healthcare team. That's why the model was built with a dietitian, mm-hmm. with the social worker, mm-hmm. with a nurse mm-hmm. to turn that around.
Okay.
It was yeah. built that way. And now, like whether that's successful or not, yeah. that's a whole other.
No. And like BJ said, there is that psychological testing that they do before the transplant.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So they have to have passed that. But like Maria says, you have to take. And I know when they call and say, hey, has this patient, they're on the list for transplant. Are they ready for transplant? Have they been compliant?
They call and check.
They compliance. Call and check. And like I tell our patients, everyone that's on the list, they will call and check, and I have to be honest.
Okay.
Now,
Maria. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. Go ahead. Sabrina just wants to talk about money.
Since we were talking about noncompliance, when for those anti-rejection medication, I think a better way to say it, are there common side effects? I mean, I know there's side effects to any medication, but are there common side effects that make it where people are more prone to not taking the meds?
Other than just pill burden, it's not just one pill a day. It's multiple okay. pills. You know, with any medication, weight gain, nausea. Right.
Yeah, prednisone. Stomach. They give a lot mm-hmm. of that initially, a lot right. of prednisone. But BJ, I would wager to think that it would be better than sitting up at a dialysis unit six hours.
I know that, minute. But okay. If we look at another condition that's, you know, you look at mental illness, one of the biggest right. issues for noncompliance and mental illness is people don't like the way it makes them feel. They,
okay.
you know, so I was just wondering for those kinds of drugs, is mm-hmm. that something where people just feel they're not themselves, and therefore they'd rather be on dialysis.
Well, mm-hmm. there's always a new pill coming out every day. Yeah. Pharmaceutical companies are making big bucks.
Good RX cover those meds.
With what?
Good RX.
Good RX.
No. All right, Sarita, what are you saying about this money?
I was just going to add to what Maria was talking about. According to Eunos again, when we talk about transplantations, they say 95% of the transplants last only for a year.
Yeah.
85 to 90 last up to 5 years, and below 75% last up to 10 years. And I'm going to circle back around to that again. I just want to go to some United States
Renal Data System.
Thank you. Just for the cost of peritoneal, you're talking about $53,000 per year. And for hemodialysis, you're talking about $90,000 per year. So we've kind of covered that in some of our previous episodes, but I wanted to put that money back on the table.
Okay.
So the question that kind of came to me is, when you're talking about life, transplantation, and you're talking about $17,000 a year after and $262,000 in the first year. You're talking about a Medicare primary patient, which means the money's coming filtering from the government.
Straight from the government.
So now I have to ask you, is there a cap? And I think BJ may have said it earlier, but we talk about what is the value of life? And I mean, even though that sounds horrible, it has to be a legitimate question, especially when you deal with the story that Maria shared, where she got a kidney from her father, didn't take her medicine, and now she's back on dialysis. And so what is...
Not only did she not appreciate the gift she was given, she didn't appreciate her father for giving her that gift.
And looking for another one.
She's on the list.
Oh, yeah.
And because she didn't do what she did in the first time, she's eligible for... Another kidney?
You're eligible as long as you go through the transplant process where they check you from head to toe. And if you can accept it and you're showing compliance at that time, you are eligible. Yeah.
Right. They don't discriminate. You're talking about funds. You're talking about money.
Yeah.
We're back to the money again. So why would I discriminate when it comes to it? I don't care who I... We're talking about money.
Well, I know Gary Coleman got two.
Okay, leave.
Leave
Gary alone. Okay.
So, Rita, because you're throwing these numbers out and you know, I have to ask, are you saying $53,000 out of pocket?
The cost is $53,000 per year. And that's either going to come from your insurance company, less your copay, or it's going to come from Medicare itself.
Medicare covers all of that?
No, 80%. 80% of what are billable charges, 80% of billable charges. So the very population of people that we're talking about that have job disparities, Sarita.
Okay.
That most of them don't even make but $20,000 a year. You see what I'm trying to say? That's why it is important for us to stop, get a seat at the table, and look at what we're doing.
Right.
You know, I don't want people to keep giving me a fish. We need to teach these people of color, these patients of color, that they need to teach them how to fish.
That's true.
I have a question for you, though. And this is something interesting. It really was for my trivia portion, but I have to ask this question. I look at people in the sports, and I know we have some male listeners out there, so, you know, I want to include them.
Okay.
We look at Alonzo Mourning.
Okay.
Or Sean Elliott, played for the San Antonio Spurs.
Both
of them were recipients of kidney transplants. But once they received their kidneys, the only advertising and promotion they did was for the facility that took them through the system. So if you have people that are famous for whatever reason.
Right.
And millions and millions of people are watching them and paying attention to them.
Yeah.
Shouldn't they be on the front line of trying to educate?
Well, I think that's a deep question. First of all, I think a lot of people don't even want folk to know that they're, especially famous people, they don't want folk to know that they've been on dialysis. Okay. So it has to be kind of like self-interest. Now, we have this burden where all of us are in here talking about it, and we have agreed to give back to the community, okay? So, again, if you don't want people to know that you're on dialysis, you're not going to do a whole lot to advertise about renal failure, renal disease, even if it is affecting your community.
Well, why is that? Because people will come out and say, I'm a reformed alcoholic. Mm-hmm. I'm a your kidney failed.
Yeah.
Why is it that you can't?
Because it was like BJ said about the taboo. What did you say about the taboo that they don't feel like end-stage renal disease? They feel like it's a self-inflicted disease, right, BJ?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Well, we talked about that where there is this sort of blaming the victim that, you know, we know that it's a large percentage of renal failures due to noncompliance.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But the noncompliance doesn't take in consideration maybe some of the other health determinants. You know, mm-hmm. It's just that you weren't compliant, and we don't look at what noncompliant means.
Right.
And there are other factors involved in noncompliance other than you just didn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But if that's the predominant concept or image is that you just didn't do it, then it's on you.
But as Sarita said, there's a whole lot of money being put on that. But
ask this question again. It's just blowing my mind. So you're saying that $10,000, even if you're on Medicare, $10,000 a year, you're going to be expected to somehow find to provide for your Medicare.
If it's $90,000 a year for hemodialysis, then mm-hmm. you're expected. Remember, Medicare only covers 10%.
80.
Percent. I'm so sorry. Medicare only covers 80%. So you're responsible for that 20%.
Right.
All right.
So that's $18,000 to $20,000
that you're responsible for.
If I'm getting HEMA.
Right. And if PD, what was PD against, Sarita?
50. I had that as 53,000.
53. Okay.
53,000. So that's still 10,000 in excess of 10,000.
Right.
I've got to come up with every year.
Right. So transplantation appears to be the cheaper route because basically that's a one-time hit.
But it's,
it's cheaper with the anti-rejection drugs.
Right.
But it's not pushed because no one is making money off of
that's
transplant.
That's right. Remember, you don't have to go to dialysis anymore after you get your transplant.
Mm. And even in some of these large LDOs, large dialysis organizations, that 20% that they should be collecting, a lot of them do not.
Well, they have what they call a foundation.
Hardship or financial hardship.
Hardship. Mm-hmm. They absorb that.
Yeah.
So the patients never have to pay that $10,000, $20,000 a year.
So it's out of sight, out of mind.
That's right.
Yeah.
To get the sure money from the, to get sure money from the insurance company.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You know.
Yes. So, and make do with that.
Yeah.
So just one quick follow-up question.
Mm-hmm.
With hospitals and medical bills, I think my understanding is that that does not go against your credit. But is that correct or incorrect?
Now, Sarita, why we get on credit?
We on credit because if it goes against your credit, that's another barrier affecting people of color.
That's true.
It is because, again, a lot of people of color don't have credit. So it would make sense
credit,
to me.
It ain't just good.
There you go. Thank you, ma'am. I appreciate you, Rita. Thank you so much. That answers my question.
Sorry.
Oh, so bad credit, still credit.
That's right.
Okay, you guys. Well, you know, this is going so great, but we've got to wrap this up. So I need some final thoughts. Let's start with Maria.
All right. Maya Angelou said,
what is your credit score? Okay.
Maya Angelou said, do the best you can until you know better. Mm-hmm. Then when you know better, do better. So with these treatment options, choosing that treatment option is a personal decision.
Mm-hmm.
It's important that your choice supports your lifestyle and values. And the right treatment for you depends on these factors and your medical condition. But it is a personal decision.
All right. Rita.
The donation of organs and tissue is one of the most important legacies a human being can leave behind. So please sign up and be an organ donor and a tissue donor.
All right. BJ, what say you?
Okay. Well, historical justifications for making these medically biased decisions have to be called into question. And in the future, the healthcare industry needs to move away from this one-size-fits-all model so that any prescribed treatments are culturally appropriate for the patients that they serve.
So true. Sarita, let's talk about your final thought with regard to finances. You know, we don't make a whole lot of money. We're frontliners. We're garbage collectors. What are we? What all do we do? You know, minorities have the
cashiers.
We're in the service industry.
Service industry. Okay. So, what say you about all this money that's floating around, and what's going to happen in the future?
Well, in my studying for this show, one of the things I ran across on the UNOS website again was talking about how to finance your transplantation.
Okay. Right.
And they talked about savings accounts, selling property, a number of other things to come up with your portion of the money.
Well, did you say, hold on.
Sell property.
did you say?
Yes, ma'am. This is our final thoughts, okay?
Okay.
So what it occurred to me is I can't afford a transplant.
Okay.
Now, Rita, I'm going to take your side on the organ donation.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I have been living by the philosophy I was taking everything with me on my way out of
here. That's right. You did say that.
Yeah. But I think it's important for people to donate, number one. You know, sign the back of the card on your driver's license or whatever you need to do, donate. Also, you've got to start living a healthier life because as little or as much of the money that's required for sustainability, we don't have it.
Yeah.
When you say savings account, that's for me to go buy 4 new tires.
Yeah.
That's not the copay for an organ transplant such as this. And so we've got to look at some things differently, and people have to understand that the cost. And if you just do some things differently, you won't have that problem.
Wow. Profound statement. And my final thought, we as Americans have a market-driven focus on life, which has outpriced the value of one's life. Remember, a silent friend is worse than a vocal enemy.
Be sure to catch us on social media on our website, kickingitwithkidneys365.com, also on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube.
Well, all right. During our next episode, we'll be talking about the psychological stages of end-stage renal disease and how to choose a treatment option which is best suited for you and for your lifestyle. We hope you've enjoyed our show. Look forward to you joining us again on Kicking It with Kidneys.
Well, that's it for today. Thank you for listening to Kicking It with Kidneys with your host, Cindy Barclay. See you next week. The views expressed on this podcast are educational and opinion-based. These are not medical doctors.